Accession number 12910, Reel 9.
Mr. Imre Reel 9.
As superintendent of police in charge of Accra, I was by law bound to sign permits for processions and for meetings. And so in this case, I did this in terms of the agreement between the Commissioner of Police and the organisers of this procession. And I should reiterate by saying that this procession was permitted, in terms of my permit, permitted to go to the Secretariat, where it would be received by a senior government officer who would take it to Sir Gerald Creasy, the governor, and that this Secretariat was well off the route, the direct route through the town up towards Government House. So that was the situation. The permit had been given to these people. Saturday morning, February the 28th, in Accra, as I've already said, was significant in that the boycott on the trade boycott was to be lifted. And also the procession was due to start around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I spent that morning in the town trying to sense the atmosphere, and it became apparent to me, knowing the general feeling of the place, that there was an air of disappointment over the prices in the town of foodstuffs and imported goods, which everybody had hoped were going to be lowered. But they weren't lowered to the amount that had been hoped. So there was this disappointment. I talked with James Moxon, the DC, about the procession in the afternoon, and he said, well, if he was wanted, he would be on a certain telephone line. I told him what I was going to do. I said, well, I am going to my office, and I am going to be central, I'm going to be on the telephone with my various dispositions, police dispositions, and I'm going to keep myself informed about the procession by motorcycle dispatch rider. I should say something about these dispositions that I made, and I must go back a little bit to the meeting 2 days before in Ballantyne's office. Because finally, having said to Ballantyne that I think things could go wrong, he said to me, you don't need to worry at all. He said, and Eccle, that's the deputy, agrees with me. He said, all you need, and this is significant, I've never forgotten it, he said, all you need is 6 escort policemen to show the procession round the town. There was no point in my going on any further because I should have been insubordinate. So I saluted and walked out. I went straight to my office then, and I made certain dispositions which involved something like 100 men. And they are all set out, the dispositions I made are all set out in the white paper that subsequently followed after all this was over. Anyway, they were dispositions which kept police off the main route, but capable of convergence, if need be, on a particular point. And I had already decided on what point, if things went wrong, I had already decided on what point I was going to make a stand and stop the procession getting to Government House, because I was pessimistic about the outcome of this procession. Having heard the Commissioner's views on this and Eccles, I thought I must go and see the military. I had never met the area commander, who was a brigadier, but I knew his staff officer. And I went and spoke to staff officer. Oh, first of all, I went to the colonel in charge of the local battalion of troops, whom I knew as a friend. And he said to me, he said, well, I think you better go and see the area commander. And because it was a tricky situation. There was I going over the head of my own chief by going to the military and doing various things that Ballantyne had said were unnecessary. So I went to the colonel first, and he listened to me. He said, you'd better go and see the area commander, Brigadier Hindley. This I did through my friend, who was a staff officer to him. Geoffrey Hindley listened to me without saying a word, and he eventually looked up and he said, of course, he said, you're going over the head of your own commission of police, aren't you? And I said, yes, of course, sir, I am, but I've got these feelings about the whole thing. I'm pessimistic about the outcome of this procession, and I'm telling you now that I am pessimistic, and that if there is an outbreak, you may possibly find yourself implicated as the army, the local unit of the army. So he said, right. He said, I will tell Colonel Colbeck, who was a man I'd already seen, I will tell Colonel Colbeck to have his battalion at X hours readiness. And he said, well, that suits you. So I said, yes, sir, it will. And I saluted and went out. So we're back again now to the 28th, and we're back again to midday. I had my lunch, and I went to my office, and there I established contact with the various units at my dispositions. Everybody was in place, the telephone was working, my dispatch riders were working, everything was in order, as far as I knew. The thing I was worried about was that I had distributed some supplies of tear gas to each officer commanding each unit, my units around, and I wasn't happy about the tear gas. 18 months before, I had told police headquarters that I thought the tear gas ought to be renewed, and nothing had been done about it. I had tried out two or three of the canisters, and they hadn't been terribly successful. They'd worked up to a point, but they weren't much good. They weren't as they should be. Nobody had done anything about it. But I had to make the best of it I could. I had also tried out the water hydrants around Accra, because I thought possibly we might have to repel a riotous crowd, possibly, by means of water hoses. The water hoses, which I had also recommended, ought to be reinstalled, and fresh ones overhauled generally, didn't work at all well. They were, some of them were leaking, and I wasn't happy about them. So all I had to rely on was my own dispositions, police dispositions, in case the procession got out of hand. I kept under my own hand, ready with a lorry standing by, 12 men armed with the ordinary 303 rifles. I wasn't proposing to let those out of my own hand or out of my own command. If anything happened, I could concentrate my dispositions and I could get to the scene quickly with my lorry load of armed men, 12 armed men. From 2 o'clock onwards, I watched the progress of this procession. It formed up in military style at that stage, being mainly composed of ex-servicemen. And I hoped that from that point they might, after all, do what the procession permit had authorised them to do, and that was go to the secretariat, receive the permit, and then break off and go away. But they didn't. They went straight down into the town in military formation, and during their progress down the town, they were joined by all sorts of thugs in and around the Croix, who certainly were not ex-servicemen. They got in and around some of the bars in the town, and it doesn't take very much to make an African fairly well lubricated with drink. And they all, by that time, by the time around 2:30, many of them had undoubtedly had quite a lot to drink. My dispatch riders came every now and again to tell me what was happening. The telephone from certain points that I had arranged down the town worked very well. Telephone operators were doing their job. I'd primed them to do their job, and they did. So I was well aware of what was happening the whole time. I knew that the procession was liable to go astray, at least I feared it, because they were all getting far too much alcohol inside them, and they were down in the middle of the town, and all they had to do now, if things were going to go wrong, was go straight crack up the road towards Government House. And then the procession began to move, and they did. They were going straight up the road, right towards Government House, a distance of about 1.5 miles, something like that. I had got en route at one of the posts, police posts, I had 20 men under an African inspector. They were instructed under no circumstances to show themselves unless the procession tried to get past that post along the main road. The procession did try to get past them and did get past them, and the police came out and tried to stop them. They brushed aside without any trouble at all. At that stage, I realised I was for it. I rang my various dispositions. I had 50 men, I think, and I think there were 50, under Major Lane, Major Barry Lane. He was at the Secretariat with lorries ready to converge on the point I'd decided on. I had Robert Reeve at Government House, and I had another party which also could converge on my main point. I didn't like the point that I had chosen, but it was the only possible one. I didn't like it because the flanks were exposed, and indeed there were piles of stones in one place, which I didn't like at all. But it was the only possible place that I could have any hope of getting to and stand standing. So, into my lorry I got my armed men, and away we went. We all converged on this point. And we only got there just in time. The procession was by that time extremely noisy. Many of them were carrying sticks, which they were brandishing aloft. They were singing and shouting and making a tremendous noise. We got there just in time, and I deployed the men across the road. The flanks were unprotected. I couldn't do anything about it. I had my behind-the-baton party. I had my armed party across the road. I realised straight away that baton charges were going to be practically useless, and I didn't try them. What I did do was to... I ordered a bugler. I had a bugler with me. I ordered a bugler to sound the action, which he did, and I stepped forward, put up my hand, and I shouted out to these people, both in English and in Hausa, to stop. I said that they were illegal, they were against the terms of their permit, and they were not to go to Government House, which they wanted to do. We're obviously trying to do. By this time, stoning had started heavily. We were all hit. It was heavy stoning. There was a leader in front with another man his, obviously his number two, and this leader was blowing a sort of wooden trumpet and urging people forward. They stopped for a moment when they heard the bugle and saw my hand upraised, but then they started to come on again, and I realised we were absolutely for it, and nothing we could do. So again my hand went up, and I said, "You're going to stop or I'm going to open fire." And there was certain confusion, but they were quite clearly coming forward again. By this time, I suppose they were 25, 28 yards away in front of us, and we were going to get engulfed. And so I went through the fire orders, present at the knees in front, and finally I shouted, by this time I was just at the side, I said, "Fire!" And not a rifle went off, not a single shot went off. And we were going to get engulfed. And I seized a rifle from one of the men, and I fired six shots. I fired at the man with a horn, the wooden horn, and I fired at his deputy, and I killed them both. And I fired four more shots. Because by that time, as these two went down, so the crowd started to surge back. And by that time, then I fired one more shot, and they started to run. I fired three more shots, and they were all helter-skelter away down the road. Away. And that was really the end of the story, to a large extent, as far as I was concerned there. I had also, although the depot staff under a man called Major Ames were not under my command, I had previously alerted Ames, asked him if he would put his men under barrack, detain them in barracks in case I needed them, in case they were needed. And they were all in uniform. And somebody somewhere must have got hold of them from my headquarters and alerted everybody to what was happening. There were these two dead men in the road, and the Commissioner of Police suddenly arrived in uniform. And I went up to him and saluted and reported, "Two dead, sir, and four wounded. Four probably wounded. Six shots in all," I said. And he said, I can remember his words, he said, "Bloody good show." He said, "You were right and we were wrong." Anyway, then Ames and his party arrived. So did Eccle with a large party. And by that time, the crowd was starting to come back again. And the sporadic stoning had begun again here and there. Ballantyne told me to get out of sight, because obviously it was known that I had fired and that my presence would inflame the crowd. So I was told to go up to Government House, where possibly the governor might want to see me. So I got a vehicle and started to go. But just about that time, along came Colonel Colbeck with his units of his battalion. And the whole situation at the crossroads was stabilised. I got to Government House, where by that time I recognised a whole lot of the nationalists were starting to gather. And I went up right into Government House. I can't remember, it's all a bit of a blur from now on, but I must have stayed at Government House for about an hour and a half. I was bleeding all over, so was Barry Lane. And we were attended to by Lady Creasy, bound up and one thing and another. And then telephone messages started coming in from the town saying that looting was becoming widespread. All the European and Syrian-owned shops were being looted and that there were fires in various parts of the town. And what were the orders? Because I was still in charge of Croix. Ballantyne suddenly turned up, and he then relieved me of command of the police in Accra, because obviously it was known that I had done this, and I was no longer, obviously, I was persona non grata with everybody. What arrangements he made for somebody to take command of Accra at that stage, I don't know, but apparently the whole thing was very muddled, and I don't think anybody was in command of Accra for quite a while. And that was really the end of the party, as far as I was concerned. That night, Eccle and I went round all the police stations in Accra, and we removed all the rifles from the police stations and brought them into the central armoury, because it was then thought that this was a wise thing to do in view of an outbreak which appeared to have become general. And the army, I know, were called upon to act. The governor called Brigadier Hindley in to see him and told him he wanted him to take command. And as far as the police were concerned, the police would come in behind the army after the army had restored peace and order, law and order. And that's really what happened. I didn't see, personally, very much of what happened after that, because I was told to keep out of the way. I was given a job as liaison officer between the police and the army, which meant that I attended all security councils. And I was the commissioner's emissary to the army, to Brigadier Hindley, on all sorts of things. And I was in on roughly what was going on. And this really was a position for the next couple of months. In the meantime, the Nationalists had sent telegrams everywhere, to America, to the Colonial Office, to everybody they could think of, saying, "This is the last governor of the Gold Coast. We, the Africans, are ready to take over." And so on and so on and so on. So that was the situation. I, for my own part, I can only really talk about my own part. In due course, a commission of inquiry came out and sat. And they took the shooting at the crossroads incident first. And I'm glad to say I managed to come out of that with flying colours, and I was congratulated by the chairman of the Commission of Inquiry, who was, I've forgotten his name now, but he was a leading legal man from Britain. And after I had given my evidence, I was got out of the colony just as quickly as they could get me, because I had finished. I was no longer any use to anybody there because of my past, the part that I'd played in this. And I went home.
Could I ask you some questions what you said? Did it surprise you that the policeman refused the order to fire?
Yes, and I never got over my surprise. Nobody has ever yet advanced any reason for this. The general idea was that there was a tremendous hubbub going on. Most of the policemen had been hit by stones, as indeed I had, and so had Barry Lane. And in the general confusion, it is believed that my order to fire was either not heard or misconstrued. And that's all that has ever emerged out of it. There has never been any suggestion that the escort policeman refused to fire. I'm going to qualify that. Because this has only just occurred. I have been in correspondence with a man called Anthony Deku, who is a Ghanaian, and this correspondence went on for about a year before it suddenly stopped. And in this correspondence, Anthony Deku told me that apropos of that incident where the men didn't fire, he said they were stopped firing by the gestures of an African inspector who was well known to me. I remember this inspector being there, and he, in fact, had been in charge of the men at the police post that they had been, who had been brushed aside. And he said, "Don't fire, don't fire, don't fire," according to Deku. Now, whether this is true or not, I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. It's possible. I don't know. And that is the only suggestion that has ever been advanced as to why they didn't fire.
Because you said previously that you had approached Ballantyne about your worries about the reliability of the general police.
That's right. The general police, but not the escort police. And it was the escort police who composed my firing party.
Was that inspector a northerner or a southerner?
He, in fact, was a northerner, but he was illiterate, and he had a very, very good reputation as an inspector and as everything, as a loyalist and everything. I don't know.
Do you think it's possible that, because of the disturbed situation you've already described, which had arisen in the Gold Coast after the war, with the coming of Indian independence and everybody saying that Gold Coast was going to become independent, do you think that that could have affected the reliability of the police in their unwillingness to fire on a crowd when the people who were organising the demonstration might be the next in power?
It could very well be, but by and large, I was one of those, I was one of most of us, I think. I shared the general view that the escort police, as northerners, would probably have been totally loyal. I would always have hoped so. And but as you quite rightly say, although there's no evidence, it could have been that even the escorts had been subverted. Their loyalty had been subverted. I'm quite open to believe that, although at the time I would have thought no.
The organisers, I think you said you had talks with them beforehand about the arrangements for the procession. Mm. How many people were there, and what kind of people were there?
There were three. One of whom was an ex-serviceman, and the other two were really old clerks. But this chap was one of the ex-service administrative staff. There was an association of ex-servicemen, and this man, I think, called himself the president of the association.